You're listening to Irish Radio Canada's Home and Abroad, and I'm delighted that I am in Thurles, and I am in the GAA Museum. And the GAA was founded in Thurles in 1884. And if you happen to be visiting, it is a beautiful location just off the main street down. You find what would be like an old courthouse or an old bank building, and it's also the tourist office. So you'd have a good reason to come in and go into the tourist office and spend a bit of time. And Seamus King is with me, and Seamus is going to give me a little bit of a tour around here and tell us what you're going to see when you walk in, and a little bit about the history, the establishment of the museum, and the memorabilia that are here. Seamus Tafáilte, Cormier Mahagat.
Well, Austin, I'm delighted to talk to you, and I'm delighted that you're spreading the story of Irish, of Ireland and Gaelic games and hurling and football and all the rest in Canada and wider afield. So in actual fact, what I'm going to do is to take you around Lorna Park. That's the actual official name of the museum. And it was opened in 1992 by Mary Robinson, who was President of Ireland at that time. And it originated because of a great collection of GAA memorabilia by a man called Sam Melbourne, who had a drapery store here in Thurles back in the 30s. And in 1935, he started collecting hurleys and slitters and boots and everything else like that. And he built up this great collection. And he was very generous with it. He actually moved from Dublin, from Thurles to Dublin eventually. And he used to set out from Dublin in his van, bringing these memorabilia. And if there was a function, say a GAA event someplace around the country, he would set up stalls, so to speak, and introduce people to some of these old hurleys and slitters and various things like that. So eventually he continued doing this until 1988, and he was no longer capable of doing so. So he was looking for a home for his collection. So he contacted the Tipperary County Board, and they purchased the lot. I think they paid $20,000 for it at the time, which was substantial money, but it was a substantial collection. And they purchased this building, which was, as you said, a bank building, in fact. And from that, this museum developed. And what I'm going to do today now is just bring you across to some of the highlights in it. And
Before we get to the highlights of that, the GAA itself, because it was founded here in Thurles.
That's right, 1884.
1884, and yeah. It was founded just up the street.
In Hayes's Hotel. And it was founded in Hayes's Hotel, and the man, the driving force behind it, was Michael Cusack, a Clare man who had gone to Dublin and who had seen. So he was used to hurling in Clare before he went to Dublin. He saw that the game was disappearing, and he realised that it had to be, something had to be done to prevent its demise completely. So he came up with this idea of forming an association for the revival, the preservation and revival of the game of hurling, and of course football was added to it in the course of time. Seven people, he had a great notion when he started out, because he sent out 60 letters for this meeting to take place in Hayes's Hotel on November the 1st, 1884, but only seven turned up, which of course must have been rather disappointing for the man, but he stuck at it. And the amazing thing, as he said at one stage, it spread like a prairie fire, the story of the GAA and the development of it. And I think the strength of it, why it developed so well, I think was due to the fact that the unit of the organisation was the club. And the club was based on the parish, and the parish had a certain loyalty. People had a loyalty to their parish, and they transferred that loyalty then to the club, or the existence of the parish strengthened the loyalty to the club. And then after the club, there was the county, and the county became the unit. And some people would claim that the county loyalty that people have, you're a Sligo man or you're a Galway man or whatever the case might be, is due to one's association with the game of hurling and the way it is identified with the club, the hurling or the football, and how it intensifies one's love and loyalty for one's county or club. So from that point of view, I think that's been the strength of the organisation and why it became so great.
And Seamus, when you mentioned that along that, that the division was, or the unit initially was the parish, and of course that tied in with the schools, and it also tied in with more every aspect of cultural life. So you had a unified promotion. So, but some parishes would have been very strong in one sport or another, and that evolved over time, be it football or hurling. But also you got the rivalry that was inevitable, and both at parish level and then at county level. And over time, I guess, greater rivalry developed as some counties emerged and some clubs emerged stronger than others.
That's correct. And also, it does show a division in the country between what we might call the hurling area and the football area. The football covers all 32 counties and is reasonably strong all over, whereas hurling is confined more to the south, the southwest, stretching from Wexford, Waterford across to Galway, incorporating Cork, Kilkenny, Clare, Galway, these things. Now, there is hurling played in every county, but this is the stronghold of it. And in the All-Ireland Championship, which is played every year, usually it is from that central core area that the county champions come.
And of course, I have a particular loyalty to Galway, which was good for football and hurling, and some of the greats out of there, even Sean Silk was my time in school, as was Iggy Clark. Those names kind of helped Galway achieve greatness.
They did, and actually they have achieved greatness in both codes, in hurling and in football. They're an example of a county that is as strong in one as in the other. But their hurling fate, so to speak, has been thwarted by the fact that the game was organised on a provincial basis originally, and Galway was the only county in Connacht.
Right.
That was a hurling team. Well, it had other hurling teams, but Galway was the only strong county.
Right.
And it used to get into an All-Ireland semi-final every year, and because it had little or no contests coming up to the semi-final, they found it difficult to win semi-finals and get to the finals.
Right.
Now, a few years ago, it was decided to move Galway for playing purposes into Leinster.
Right.
And they're in Leinster now. They have done a bit better, and so on, because they have more competition now being part of Leinster.
Right. As with when you talk about the formation in Hayes Hotel up the road, as within any sport, it doesn't matter what country you're in, it doesn't matter what the sport is, there is always a trophy that is sought.
Yeah.
In football, it's Sam Maguire. In hurling, Liam McCarthy. We're standing beside a trophy here, and this trophy was the first trophy, as I understand it, that would have been played for. Is that correct?
No. Actually, this is a different one. This is okay. Called the Croagh Fennelly Cup, because it was actually originally got by Archbishop Thomas Croagh, the man after whom Croagh Park is called, and the man who was very much strong in the foundation of the GAA in Thurles. And basically, what he looked for at one stage was he was building churches. He was the Bishop of Cashel and Emly, and there was a lot of church building going on at the time, and churches cost money. So the decision was made to run hurling competitions or hurling tournaments in order to get people to attend and raise the money for the churches. And in order to make the tournament more attractive, he contacted some friends of his in the States to come up with a trophy. And this was the trophy that they came up with, which is doesn't look like a hurling trophy. It's more like a tea urn rather than anything else. But it's a beautiful trophy, and it built churches. That trophy built churches.
So this is the precursor of bingo.
Of
bingo.
maybe, yeah. But anyway, and it's called after Croagh, because Croagh used it, and then his successor was Bishop Fennelly, and he used it, and that is why it's known as the Croagh Fennelly Cup. And when we opened this museum back in the end of the century, Bishop, the bishop at the time actually presented this to, he had it in his house,
right.
So he presented it to us.
Brilliant.
And it is one of the most beautiful things that we have here, one of the most beautiful exhibits, the Croke Fennelly Cup.
I'm looking over here and I see two whatever sticks. There's Kevin Barry's hurley and there's another one. And what's particularly noticed about them is the shape, because the shape is closer to what Canadians are familiar with as a hockey stick.
Yeah.
Now I know it has evolved since and that the bus has changed, but at that time the original stick was very much in line, I guess, and that's where the hockey stick ultimately grew some of its shape.
That is correct, but also it was very similar to the hockey stick, but it was more for ground hurling, what we call ground hurling, hitting the ball on the ground. Today the game has been transformed. The hurley has been transformed. It is no longer a long curved boss like that. It is a shorter stick with a wider boss that facilitates picking the ball off the ground, striking it in the air, so to speak. And it has transformed the game. It has made the game so much a more exciting. Well, some people would say that it has lost some of its physicality, that it is more a skillful game, actually approaching the kind of, it's not soccer, because a person has a stick in his hand, the player has a stick in his hand, but it's possession is the name of the game, and it's driving the ball long distances and having the ability to score points, which are between the posts or under the posts if you want to get goals and so on like that. So it's a totally different game. It has speeded up enormously. Some of the physicality has gone out of it, even though it's still a tough game. And it's reflected in the kind of hurley that is used today, in contrast to that hurley that you're talking about here before us.
They took the physicality to hockey.
Yeah.
Here we're looking at the Schlitter.
Yeah.
And the Schlitter, for someone listening and who isn't familiar with it, is very like a hardball for baseball. It has the same ridges on it, although the baseball, the ridges may not be as high. And it's leather stitched, and the stitching is where the same shape as, I say, a baseball. And we're looking at a number of examples going back over a period of time. The original Schlitter would have been a leather and would have got heavy as it got wet.
That is true, and the contrast again between the contrast between the hurleys of then and presently, the contrast is a major, because the ball is very light now, and whereas the original Schlitter was that kind of grey dull colour and all the rest, the modern Schlitter that is used in all major games now has a yellow finish, because it's easier to see against
on
the sunlight,
on the camera.
And camera can pick it out,
yeah.
And all the rest like that. But ultimately, the ball would maybe slightly smaller to what it was in the past, but it's still a core of cork, encased in threads and covered in leather. So it is the basic structure of the Schlitter remains the same.
I remember it would have been about 1990, I think, going to Toronto, because there was the Irish teams were over, and some people sitting beside me, and they couldn't understand how people would put their hand up and grab the Schlitter out of the air with no gloves on.
Yeah.
And that's part of the game, that this object comes flying through the air at horrendous speed, and a guy will put his hand up, grab it down out of the air, and play from there on.
Yeah, that's one of the great skills in the game, the ability to put your hand up and not get a belt on the hand, because your hand is protected. They go up with one hand and they have the hurley protecting the ball from, or protecting the hand from behind.
Right.
It's a great skill.
And again, while we were talking about the hurley itself, like my understanding is hurling is the fastest ball game on earth. On land, like hockey is faster, and there are some other, but on land, as I understand it, It's probably the fastest ball game.
Probably will we claim that one of the fastest,
and we never tell lies.
At its best, the speed, the field, so to speak, the pitch for hurling is 150 metres long now, I think. We used to get 160 yards. I think it's 150 metres long, which is possibly, it is, I'd say, the longest actual pitch for any sporting game.
Right.
The ball moves at such speed from one end of that field to the other, you know, and it can move by maybe a long puck of the slitter that somebody might drive it 100, 120 yards. Or it can be passed quickly from one player to another, and as they move between their opponents.
And the ability of the player to have the stick with the boss, and the boss is like literally the palm of that, like palm, to have the ball, the slitter, balanced on the stick and run at full speed, and that ball stays nearly as if it was glued to the stick, is a phenomenal skill.
It is, yeah. The solo running, of course.
Yeah.
The famous Limerick player Mick Mackay was the man that's supposed to have introduced the solo run. The solo run being that you carry the ball on your hurley, tossing it up on the hurley, and you move quickly. And the story is told, I suppose, like so many stories apocryphal, that Mick Mackay, he used to grab the ball and keep it close to his chest, and in many cases he had it in his hand rather than knocking it on the hurley, you know. That's what they used to say about him anyhow, you know.
But as the skill developed, we've seen guys running on the hurley. It's way out there, and the skill has. But the other phenomenon of this game, which is magnificent, is you can see a player on the run pick up a ball without touching it in the hand, give it a little flick, take a swing at the hurl, and then hit this amazing shot that they're capable of scoring from 50, 60 yards out.
Yeah, DJ Carey, one of the greatest shots in an All-Ireland that I saw was DJ Carey collecting about 50, 60 yards, running on, as you were saying, picking the ball up, tossing it on the hurley and striking it, never putting it into his hand and getting it between the posts.
Yeah.
It was a phenomenal shot, phenomenal stroke.
And likewise, when someone is shooting from way out, because in the off the ground shot, if it goes what in other football sports would be when a known player puts it behind the line, and there is a 70 yard, isn't it, or what is it now, 60 meter,
65
meter shot from the ground, that a player can come along, lift it up, flick it from 65 metres and get it between the posts.
That's true. Yeah. There's some great shooting.
I know.
But again, that shooting comes from practice.
Yeah.
You know, you don't suddenly put a ball on the ground and hit it between the posts the first time.
And when you say practice, see, the great thing about this game, it's a bit like soccer in England. Football and hurling in Ireland can be played in the field or in the street. Unlike hockey, where you have to have the gear, you have to have the ice, you have to have so much stuff.
Yeah.
The Irish grow up with a hurdle in the hand and are a ball at their feet, and they're soloing along. So it's a game that they can develop from a young age.
Mm-hmm. True. Now, this is an interesting one here, this cap, because we hear about being capped for Ireland, and usually you talk about getting a soccer cap or a rugby cap or a hockey cap or whatever the case might be. But in actual fact, in sport, the cap, of course, it's a metaphorical term for a player's participation in a game at international level. But the caps did exist in the past. And this team, this famous Tobradora team, which is a Tipperary team, and they won All-Ireland Championships in 1895, 96 and 98, and they wore caps. They used to say about it, when men were men and wore caps. But these caps, which these players wore, were in actual fact hurling caps. And we're very lucky here to have one of these hurling caps from the Tobradora, the famous Tobradora team.
Right. Mm. Of course, nowadays with modern technology, people wear helmets.
Helmets, of course. The helmet is the whole idea today. That became compulsory. In fact, a referee will not continue a game with a player who hasn't a helmet on.
It's
standard procedure now because of the dangers of the damage to the head and so on. And as we know, the dangers of damage in sport, in rugby, is having big problems now about the damage that heads get
people as they get into their later
years,
suffering from a variety of
issues. In fact, I was reading in the Sunday Times last Sunday that the two people in the last 2 years have committed suicide because of the damage to their brains and so on like that from playing rugby, and they were so depressed by the damage that was done and the way their lifestyle had been completely transformed as a result of it, they committed suicide, which is very sad.
We walked into the museum, and the first thing that will greet you is a bit on the growth of the association and the language and culture are surrounding it. And we're here with Seamus King. Seamus, the importance of this, the language and the colour.
Yeah,
culture.
You see, it is... GAA, I've always emphasised the fact that it's more than a sporting organisation. It's as much a cultural organisation as anything else like that. And it not only supports the game and promotes the game, and that is the priority. People go to see the games. But it also promotes the Irish language and culture. As we can see here, the association strictly supports the Irish language, traditional Irish music, dancing, song, and other aspects of Irish culture. And 'tis unique from that point of view. And this is why that it embraces so many people that they may not necessarily be sorely interested in games, but they are interested in the wider culture of the Irish of Irish culture. And what is promoted is this language. And the big thing of the GAA in the early stages was that it was trying to transform Ireland from being a satellite of England into a distinctive culture in its own right. So that is why in the early days it brought in things like banning English games, banging the usual ones, soccer and rugby and hockey, and they never banned tennis for some reason. But anyway, they banned these others, and they forbade English soldiers or English policemen or whatever to join the association. They wanted to get across this idea of the distinctiveness of Irish culture, Irish games, Irish language, and so on like that. And it succeeded. They established themselves, and I use this expression, we'll see in a minute, about the very first game that was played, inter-county game, was played in February 1886 in the Phoenix Park. Michael Cusick organised it between South Galway, your place, and North Tipperary, and this was a game played, and he got a cup put up, and a few people attended that game in the Phoenix Park in 1886. And if you jump forward then to 1961, the All Ireland final that year attracted 91,000 people in Dublin between Kerry and Down, I think it was, Kerry and Down and that. So it was a huge development reflected in the growth of numbers and the growth of people supporting the game.
James, I think it's important to highlight that Gaelic games are amateur.
That's
have been. Mm-hmm. And that the pride that is somebody has in just being selected for a county team is reward enough. Now, I do know that as time has gone on, and with people working in Dublin but yet maybe playing for a county like Clare or Galway or Sligo, that it can be very expensive to go to training, and times have changed where they may be assisted in getting to some expenses. Mm-hmm. And cover. But it's still, nobody is paid to play the game.
That's right. Now, the amateur status is still there, and that is the theory. Nobody is played. But we live in an affluent society, we live in a material society, and more people are getting expenses for playing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of a camouflage, you know, that they, whereas the principle remains the same of being an amateur game and not being paid for play, there's an awful lot of ways around it, I think.
Right, but I must say, given where I'm very conscious of the price of gas when I'm visiting here.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's what, about €1.70 at the moment.
That's it.
I recently filled my tank at 99 cents a litre, which is about 60 pence.
All right, okay.
So, you know, while it might be affluent on one level, like for somebody travelling from Dublin to Sligo and back for training, it's quite an expense.
It is, I do agree. Now, before we leave this, I just want to point out something to you. One of the strengths of the GAA, we said, was basing the unit of the GAA, the club, and then the county. And they organised that the first time in 1887 when the first All-Ireland Championship was played. And they played in hurling and in football, and Limerick won the football.
Right.
You associate them with hurling today, but they were the first football winners. And Tipperary won the hurling. And I like pointing this out because if you look at that picture of the Tipperary team that won that, which was played in Burr in Easter 1888, it wasn't able to finish it in 1 year, so it went into the next year. And they had no camera that day. You see, and 25 years later, they got the guys together again, you see.
Yeah. I was looking at that and said, I thought you were going to tell me that, in the early days, the teams were made up of mature
old men.
Of mature players.
Mature players. They were mature.
And some of them were well rounded at that stage.
And as you see, some of them had died or they were emigrated or whatever, and their sons or whatever. Do you see the young lads in the front of the picture? But it's an interesting picture about it. Yeah.
And while you talk about that, as we walk along, immigration, of course, has been something that has taken its toll on Gaelic games. At various times, it has either devastated some regions of the country and left them with the difficult ability to put a team out, and then maybe a bit of a resurgence as the economy improved. But then, as time has gone on, rural Ireland is struggling and continues to struggle at last times with fielding teams.
That is correct. That's very definitely, and you can see it in. It's reflected in some clubs their inability to put out the number of teams they used to put out in the past. On the other hand, clubs that towns have expanded out into them, they're flourishing. You see,
right.
But there is that problem. There is also the problem that Irish men and women, they have more choices today.
Right.
When I was growing up, hurling was the only choice. I grew up in a country area and hurling was the only thing that was played. So there was no competition from other sports. Today, there's a huge menu of sports available for anybody. And you make your choice. And that reduces the numbers. But I think actually the number of teams still playing hurling and football is substantially high. You know that there is a kind of an innate loyalty, and even in places like Dublin now, where you would think that things might be different, Kilmacud Crokes, for instance, they have 50 underage teams.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Which is a colossal
kind
of thing. That there is still a great attraction to the games, the game of hurling.
And I guess the challenge is with urbanisation, which is not just an Irish issue, it's a global issue, certainly. With urbanisation, it means rural places, smaller areas, have a bigger challenge in fielding teams and retaining their players. Because not understanding fully, but if I lived in a rural area and I moved to Dublin, I'm able to transfer to a Dublin club, would that be correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Right, so again, given the cost of time and the pressure on time and traffic and all the rest, I'm less likely to want to head down to Sligo to train if I can head down
that's
the road
true,
to train.
True, yeah. It's a big burden. It's a big burden.
Right.
One of the things I like mentioning, we pride ourselves in hurling being one of the oldest field games in the world.
Right.
And as far as we know, the earliest historical reference we have is in 1272 BC, apparently there was some kind of a war or a row or whatever the case might be between two tribes at that stage, and before they fought they had a hurling game, and when the hurling game was over they had the fight, you know. But anyway, it shows that the extent the game goes back into the dim distant past here. So basically, when one is playing the game, one is joining with in a sport which has such a huge ancestry going back millennia, you know.
Likewise, in legend, when the legend of Cú Chulainn.
Oh yes.
And as we come along here, we're walking down towards Cú Chulainn, where he defended himself, like you say, but he uses the stick and a ball to keep a dog from attacking him, a hound from attacking him.
That's right, yeah.
And
yeah.
He was hit the lethal blow that meant he ended up as the hound himself.
Yeah. And that emphasises, I think, the antiquity of the game, that these myths and legends exist in abundance in Irish literature about games of skill, which was in on the hurling field.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And of course, and an interesting depiction here of Cú, in that the stick is a stick from a tree and just off a branch, which is probably what would have evolved ultimately, because that's all people had.
That's probably right.
Yeah. Fascinating.
So
and
anyway,
I see here
we have the
hurley makers here.
The hurley makers, but you can see there now that these are shinty sticks, as you see, and they're very like the hockey stick which we were talking about earlier on.
Exactly.
You see. And but you see the more modern hurley, the short little boss on it. And the wider boss.
Yeah.
And you can see here, for instance, the older hurley, the longer kind of a boss on it. And you see some of these now. You see that?
No, and there's names on all these. So these are all the great players.
These are all great players. There's Tommy Doyle now from Thurles Sarsfields. Jackie Power from Limerick. You see Tony Brennan from Tipperary. Diamond Hayden. You see that?
I see Liam Devaney down there. Rings a bell with me. Joe Salmon, that definitely rings a bell with me.
Yeah.
From Galway.
You know this man.
Oh.
Jack Lynch.
I was talking to his nephew recently, who has just published a book, Cathal Dunn.
Right.
Yeah, he's just published, and the book's just out now.
And Inky Flaherty.
Inky Flaherty,
from your place.
Yeah, Banlaslow indeed.
Banlaslow, yeah.
Yeah.
And Jim Langton was an outstanding forward for Limerick. Kilkenny, yeah. And Nicky Racker, the famous Nicky Racker.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, and Joseph Gallagher, another great Galway player, actually, from Gort. Yeah.
So, yeah, this is a real walk down memory lane.
It is a memory lane. It is a great thing.
It is indeed.
Yeah.
So then we're into the trophy room.
Into the trophy room, and there's an awful lot in this place. We have a good lot of trophies. I'll just mention a few of them. This one is a very interesting because this particular guy from Dundrum. He was famous for his medals. He was a great athlete, and he used to carry his medals on his chest. So to say, Tim Crow was his name.
Right.
And on special occasions, you see the picture of him there with the medals on his chest. And he was a great cyclist also. He used to cycle from Dundrum to Dublin for matches, 110
Oh, we're talking Dundrum, County Wicklow.
No, Dundrum,
County
Tipperary.
Okay, because I used to live in Dundrum, and I'm thinking,
far
into Dublin.
No, Dundrum, County Tipperary.
Right.
Yeah.
I have a few of these kind of medals from my school days.
All right.
I think they were the ones for, they haven't turned up as distinct from winning.
Yeah. Now, this is a trophy I like to talk about because this is an Argentinian hurling trophy.
Right.
Because in the 19th century,
yep,
a lot of Irish emigrated to Argentina.
The Gandhis. And they
went into sheep farming, all yep. that kind of thing. And they brought the Hurleys with them.
Yep.
And the game developed in the place. And in the course of time, they had as many as six hurling teams, and they used to have an all-Argentinian championship. And a fellow called Victor Miguez, who was married to a Westmeath woman, he put up this trophy for the Argentinian game. And the game remained strong up to the Second World War. And one of the players on the team, the Tipperary team that won it, he was given the cup to bring back to Ireland. He was returning to Ireland in 1938, and he was given the cup to bring back and look after it.
Right.
And when we opened our museum here, his family presented it to us, and we pride ourselves now in having an Argentinian hurling trophy.
I did a show a while back on the Irish in Argentina, and some of my school friends, their grandparents were Argentinian, had come back to Ireland, Ganleys and Careys up around Westmeath.
Right, okay. They say that a lot of people from the W's, from Wexford, Waterford, and from
Westmeath,
a lot of these went to Argentina for some reason. Yeah,
right.
Yes, here's another interesting one. This is the Camogie outfit, as you can see.
Yep. Given the controversy that has gone on recently, this is quite an interesting outfit.
This is an interesting outfit because that was the modest outfit that the Camogie player had to play back in 1912 when the Camogie was founded.
Right.
And this skirt had to be down to the ankles. And I understand that one of the rules of the game at the time was that if you stopped the ball with your skirt, it was a foul against you. So how you could not stop the ball with the skirt was the problem. And of course, when you think of that and their outfits today,
yeah,
and the recent controversy here about the skirts versus the skirts.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
It is indeed. Yeah. We'll take another little break before we move on.
Okay.
And it's all fascinating, as I say. If anybody is coming this neck of the woods, I would strongly recommend. Now, one of the things we commented upon, we used to go from Dublin to Cork, and we would have gone through Cashel and Kerry. And this, while Thurles is that little bit off what is the main road, I would strongly recommend that if you're in that, coming down, what is it, the M-what now?
The M8, if you're going to Cork, the M8, if you're going to Limerick, it's the M7.
So if you're on the M7 or the M8, you should certainly consider diverting.
Yeah.
And
if you're going on the M8, you're only 5 miles distant from the main road.
Yeah. I see something here which I see interesting. Landlords and hurling.
The landlords and hurling. Now, this is the most interesting one because if you read your Irish history in school, you probably learned that the landlords were, we'll call them bastards, you know, and they were anti-English and they treated the Irish badly and all the rest like that. But a number of them were very interested in hurling.
Right.
And they developed hurling teams from amongst their tenants. And they would play for wagers. Now, a wager might be five guineas or 10 guineas, and there are occasions when it was 100 guineas. And the game was played, and when it was over, the players were treated not to money, they weren't paid, they were treated maybe to drink or whatever,
food
or whatever the case might be. And this is an example of it, how they cultivated hurling during the 18th century. And that continued until the rising of 98. And it is believed that the trust, so to speak, that existed between tenants and landlords up to 98 was completely shattered, because it was an organisation really against the landlords, and there was a lot of cruelty, and it is believed that 30,000 people died in the rising of 1798, so it left a terrible scar on the country.
Right.
And after the war was over, and when we went into the 19th century, the game declined amongst the landlords.
Right.
And it became very, very, very few playing it, and it totally disappeared completely. And then actually, the game nearly disappeared during the 19th century, and particularly with the famine, because an awful lot of the people that might have been playing it were died during the famine or emigrated abroad.
Right.
So when Cusack came along then in 1884, he realised that the game was in a dire strait, and if something wasn't done soon, that it would disappear altogether. So he started the GAA, and from that the whole thing revived again, you know. But it's interesting that it did flourish during the landlords in the 18th century. And here we have a list, actually, as you can see, of the landlords who had teams, and there's quite a substantial of the number of them.
Indeed.
And one of the most interesting ones is the Baron Purcell, the Purcells of Lochmore. If you're travelling by train between Thurles and Dublin, you will pass that castle, the ruin of that castle.
We were
actually
over there yesterday.
It's
an amazing ruin.
It is. Oh, you it were is. Actually at
well, it. We could see it yesterday.
Yeah,
it is an amazing ruin.
Funny enough, actually, they say that it's just two separate castles, and it was joined on by the two. That's the latest theory on it. But Baron Purcell, there is a field over there in Purcell's which has an artificial mound at the side. And it is an artificial mound. It is believed that it was artificially created in order to give the viewers a better view of the game of hurling.
Right. Yeah. Good opportunity here. I see two books with your name on the front of them. The Tipperary GAA Story 1935-84 and then Tipperary's GAA Story 1985-2004. Mm. So if anyone is interested in a detailed story, these are still available?
They're still available.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And where should someone go for them?
Well, it's difficult. You will probably get them in shops still.
Right.
But it would be best, I'd say, to contact the Tipperary County Board.
Perfect.
I think that's the best thing. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Now we're into the woodworking shop here.
Yeah.
And in the woodworking shop, we're surrounded all size roof, walls, and a workman behind the bench.
And of course, ash. The whole principle of the game, the hurley, is made out of ash. And why is it made out of ash? I don't know really, but I do in a way, that there is a spring in ash. If you, for instance, lean on a hurley of ash, you will find that it can bend slightly.
Right.
There's a slight spring in it, and I think it helps the game. But as well as that, as you can see in this particular example, the grain in the hurley weaves around, so to speak.
It flows with the boss.
And it used to say, I was brought up in the countryside, and the best hurley you could get would be a piece of ash growing out of the bank of a tree.
Yeah,
or the bank of a river, so to speak.
All right.
Because it came out and turned up. And
okay.
It had the natural block on it.
And it was less likely to break.
And less likely to break as a result.
All right.
Well, here you have an example of not only a hurley maker, but a hurley mender as well.
Right.
And of course, living in the society we live in today, fewer hurleys are mended anymore.
Right.
The hurley is broken and thrown aside, and a new one is thrown in. But here we get examples of the way hurleys were faithfully mended. You see the way
that
piece was spliced in.
Yeah, I remember that. And the piece of tin nailed to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I understand there was a problem here and may still exist with the availability of ash.
There was, yeah. This dye ash.
The ash borer, was it?
Yeah, this dye ash is some kind of a disease that has hit ash. It was imported, I think, from abroad.
Yeah.
And there was a scare for quite some time. And during that scare, different efforts were made to build to make hurleys without Wavin, the people that make pipes, you know.
Oh yes,
pipes.
I remember them. Yeah.
Wavin produced a hurley, but it never took off.
Right.
I know that in the States they tried to produce hurleys from hickory,
Right.
And they produced lovely hurleys, but they tended to splinter in clashes, and they became dangerous. And recently, would you believe, in this country, they're producing hurleys from bamboo.
Okay.
There's a maker of hurleys in Clare, I know, I can't think of his name at the moment, but he has produced very successful bamboo hurleys, and one of the Limerick players in the All-Ireland used a bamboo hurley. Now, which is unusual.
So I guess, obviously, there has been no ruling on it.
No, you see, there's nothing against the material you use.
As long as it's wood.
It's wood, as long as it's wood. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Because, of course, over time in baseball,
that's right.
They were evolved from wood to aluminum, or aluminium.
Aluminium, yeah. Here, of course, we have our kind of wall of fame, or hall of fame.
Yeah.
And when we were doing this museum, we were trying to decide who was the best hurler, and we came up in favour of Christy Ring.
Yeah.
And who was the best hurler, second best one, Mick Mackey of Limerick.
Yeah.
Now, of course, that was back in the 90s of the last century.
Right.
But with the brilliance of Kilkenny, and Limerick and other countries or counties that have come up since, probably maybe we'd have different people now. In football, Mick O'Connell.
You had the opportunity to interview Mick.
Did you?
Oh yeah, down in we're on Valencia, and I sat down with Mick, and we had a long chat with Mick. That's a long number of years now.
Yeah, he was since outstanding.
He was outstanding.
And we picked Sean O'Neill of Down. There was an awful lot of people competing for second place. Would we pick Sean O'Neill of Down?
Going back to Mick there, one of the things he talked about was when we were talking about amateur status earlier on, how, you know, he got the train up to Dublin to play in the All-Ireland. After the All-Ireland was over, he got the train to go home because he had to go to work for something the next day. That was real amateur.
Yeah. Sure he was. He remained an amateur.
Yeah.
In his heart of hearts.
John Morley, of course, that was a player, and I remember he lost his life tragically. As far as I recall, he was shot.
Oh, that's right.
Because I think he was from around Ballyhaunis area.
Mm.
Yeah.
So again, the history of the jerseys in hurling or in the GAA is the history is very interesting. There's an example of the old kind of wool jersey.
Right. Yep.
The Ulster jersey.
Yeah.
And you can see when it was washed, if it was washed in water too hot or something else, it shrunk.
Yeah.
So that was belonged to a fellow called the Gunnar Brady of Cavan, who that wouldn't fit into his arm now, it wouldn't cover his arm.
No, it wouldn't.
But then you can see the change, the material which the clubs are jerseys
and the modern weave right up to current days, where they're light with polyester and. Yeah.
That's the Munster Senior Hurling Cup. It was really decommissioned recently and a new one provided. So we have that, actually, yeah. The final stage here, Austin, is broadcasting.
Mihal O'Hare.
Mihal O'Hare. And
then Mihal Murahertig. I see him there, and we heard his voice a little earlier on.
Yeah.
And where we were playing the GAA anthem.
And I think he did more. Now, the talk about the game was interesting. People went to see it. But so many people who didn't go to see it heard him talking about the game on Sunday afternoon.
On RTE.
On RTE radio, yes.
Yeah. And so he had a distinctive voice, as had Mihal Murahertig, and a distinctive style.
It is amazing how distinctive his voice was, and then Mihal Murahertig's when he came along.
Yeah.
He was distinctive too.
Very distinctive.
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot of people, and that's what they would associate Gaelic games with, was the voice of Mihal O'Hare and Mihal Murahertig.
But he gives such a service to the people. RTE, give their RTE. Actually, RTE broadcast their first game in 26, I think it was, between Galway and Kilkenny in our Ireland semi-final. And from that time then, they revelled in producing the game on a Sunday. But the funny thing is about it, there was one game in a Munster final at some stage, don't ask me the year, and it went to extra time.
Right.
And the extra time spilled over by 6 o'clock.
Right.
And the Angelus had to go at 6 o'clock, and the match was never finished. So people had to find out in different ways who won the game.
Yeah, I guess, you know, that's one of the things that I found amazing when I moved to Canada, that one of the reasons, I guess, some of these sports, Irish sports, the likes of hurling and football, have a difficulty on getting media attention is I couldn't understand that. Get this yellow cloth, the referees, and they'd throw it, and the game would stop. And that was because it was time for the TV ads.
Oh.
So the game was built around the TV coverage, the advertisers needed to get their slots every time. So the game had to stop.
Whereas
these games, the advertisers had to fit in at half time, and there was no break in the game.
Well, that's great that they had to actually stop the game.
Well, they would stop the game because for tape. Crazy.
It's crazy.
Seamus, it's been a real pleasure walking around here with you. And as I said a few times, certainly I would strongly urge anybody, if you have any interest, not just in the GAA, but in the history of Irish sport and what it meant as a cultural, an integral cultural part of Irish society, this museum here is well worth a visit. And if somebody comes here, are there times when there are tours provided?
You can do it to a certain extent. There's a button there. If it is a group, you contact the museum and they'll organize
somebody in advance.
Yeah.
And if that were the case, it would be as well naturally to give at least maybe a few days' notice.
Oh yeah, it would be because it's dependent on people like me and Liam to do the tours. So some of the staff do the tours also.
Brilliant. Seamus, brilliant, and as I say, it's been so educational, so informative, and I would strongly recommend that people come and visit.
Yeah.